Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Academic Life. This is the podcast for your academic journey and beyond. I'm your host, Dr. Christina Gessler, and today we're joined by Dr. Christine Emmeren, who's with the National Coalition Against Censorship. Welcome to the show, Christine.
Thank you so much, Christina.
I am so glad that you're here and that we get to learn about the National Coalition Against Censorship and specifically about what it's doing to address book bans. But before we dive into all of that, will you please tell us about yourself?
Thank you so much, Christine. It's so great to be here. I'm Christine Emmeren. I am a director at the National Coalition Against Censorship. I lead the Youth Free Expression program there. In terms of background, I have a PhD in sociology, and I've also have research experience, policy experience, and I apply that knowledge and experience to my current role.
Often when we think that people get their PhD so they can go into teaching or to working directly in academia, my understanding is you did that for a while and then you crossed over to this role?
That's correct. I was able to manage working in policy making using my research skills and also teaching at the same time. So I was able to navigate both worlds and decided, at this point of my life to dedicate my knowledge and research experience to social change and improving the experiences for, Americans under attack, so to speak, in terms of human rights and civil rights as it pertains to literacy in the United States.
Were you always a reader? Is that how you would have described yourself as a young person?
Correct. I have been an advocate for reading and a true reader throughout my life. I was lucky to have an older sibling, a few years older than I was, that paced me and also motivated me in wanting to read above grade level. So for me, it's been always near and dear to be able to, transverse different worlds, different cultures through literature, from picture books to, graduate level, literature. So I think in terms of critical thinking and writing and, global literature, all of that fascinates me.
For listeners in different parts of the world and even here in the U.S., they may not be familiar with what the National Coalition Against Censorship is. How would you describe that organization?
That's a really wonderful question. It's a nonpartisan alliance of more than 59 national nonprofits, including literary, artistic, religious, educational, professional, labor, and civil liberty groups. It engaged in direct advocacy and education to support First Amendment principles for probably nearly 50 years.
And I was looking at some of your partners, and they include the American Association of University Women, the American Association of University Professors, the Authors Guild, the Modern Language Association, the National Education Association, PEN America. It's like a who's who of the book world in a variety of ways.
That's correct.
But as you said, there's also religious organizations and fine arts organizations who are all concerned about censorship. For the New Books Network and for the academic life, we're concerned, or I can speak for myself, about book banning and what's going on with that. Book banning is one form of censorship. How does it fit into your overall mission to approach book banning?
Well, for me, in terms of the work that I do, I run a Kids Right to Read program. And it offers like supports to, you know, for basically an education and also direct advocacy to people facing book challenges. And in terms of book challenges, I'll define book challenges as those books that have been, community members have basically selected a book that they object to. And it's basically going through like a particular procedure to evaluate whether or not it will continue to remain in the curriculum or be removed. And when I speak of book bans, what I mean there are books that have been through the review process and are permanently removed from the school. So there are, you know, distinctions that are happening here. So basically the work that I do is that we support through education, through toolkits, through, through webinars and also through conferences, in terms of, you know, direct advocacy techniques to people that are facing book challenges in their schools or libraries. Particularly, we focus on the K-12 space and in terms of defending free expression rights of not only students, but also their staffs, and sometimes students that are artists. And our work on book censorship also are, you know, deal with incidents that are, you know, responsive and also strategically tailored to each situation. We are in touch with teachers, booksellers, librarians, local reporters, and also free speech advocates that are also involved in the challenge. But something to note is that we don't advocate for any particular book. We are viewpoint neutral as an organization. We have also defended the speech rights of individuals from across the political spectrum. And we also provide guidance for teachers, librarians, administrators. But in general, our position is that students are best served by books that do address controversial issues. And so we, in general, we favor more speech. So more books of all sorts should be available. But really, it's not up to us to determine. It's really the educational professionals and also stakeholders that determine which books belong in schools using objective criteria that are linked to legitimate pedagogical factors.
I was looking at some of the links that are available on your website and through some of your coalition partners, such as PEN America. And there's a map on the PEN America report on their right to read that shows the United States. And then each state is a different color depending on how many bans and challenges are going on in that state. And then it does note that those are what have been reported. And it seems that the most challenges and bans are happening in two states, Texas and Florida. Is that correct?
Well, it's basically in terms of, if you look at the book challenges, they are prevalent across probably 45 out of 50 of our states. And oftentimes actors don't report or they don't receive the media attention to allow us to fully see what is the state of, you know, what is going on. But if we take a look at, you know, some statistics that organizations such as ALA that records, challenges that they receive. So if we take a look at, 2021, they recorded, 729 challenges to over 1,500 titles. That number spiked to 1,200 challenges to 2,500 titles in 2022. And then if you look at just this year from January to August, ALA's, which American Library Association's Office of Intellectual Freedom, they reported over 69 attempts to censor library materials and also services to over 1,900 titles. So basically means it's going to exceed the previous 2 years. We've seen, a spike, of challenges in, Florida, in Texas and, other states, but it really is, a concern nationwide.
I was wondering that when I saw the map and California had no listed bans, no reported bans. And I took some time this morning to ponder what that actually means functionally. I think we've all had experiences where we've gone to the public library or to our local bookstore and we've tried to obtain a book and we are told it wasn't in stock or it wasn't on the shelf or it had been removed from circulation and the person we were talking to couldn't provide more information than that. And it occurred to me that more people might have had a book sort of quietly removed from their own access without being told that that's what's going on. So I was thinking about how it has to be reported bans for people to know. Is there a sense that there are more books out of circulation than even people realize?
Well, I think if you take a look, NCAC, we have a database called the Youth Censorship Database. And that basically, you'll see that there are little pin marks throughout. It's an interactive map that gives you a state of, you know, kind of what types of challenges have been going on over the past 5 years. And you'll see that over, you know, probably 45 states have had multiple types of challenges, including California. So I think in order for listeners to understand, you know, what books are being challenged that may not get media attention is really to go to the library board meetings. Oftentimes these meetings are recorded on YouTube and oftentimes on the website, you can find a list of meeting notes. And so really it's there that you're going to find when challenges arise and also the conversations and the, you know, the paperwork that are involved in terms of how the challenges get ultimately resolved. Also, as an American, you have a right to request a freedom of information requests. So, and that's your right as a citizen, because these are public institutions, to find out, you know, what had been going on in your districts. So, you know, I definitely encourage everybody to utilize those tools, you know, to request information, you know, through the website or through YouTube or through Freedom of Information Act, and to understand, you know, what is going on. And this also involves being active in your community, whether you decide to run for the board, library boards, or school boards, because these are areas in which, you know, members that are engaged are able to ultimately influence, you know, the types of books that, you know, remain on the shelves.
We talked a bit about the statistics about book challenges and bans, but it seems that there are certain topics or perceived topics that are more often banned. And so when we look at the books that are banned and we break down what might be some of their key themes, it seems that the almost half of them have an LGBTQ plus theme, or there's a perception that it does. And a significant number also have a main character or a secondary character of color, or the author is a person of color.
That's correct. In terms of the challenges that we've seen, you know, recently in the last probably, you know, 3-4 years, most of the controversy center on books that cover race, sexual, and gender themes. And most of it came to light in terms of like media attention in 2021. It really became a media talking point as a result of the race for state gubernatorial race of Republican Glenn Youngkin. He had, I believe it was like MAGA, you know, supporters that were able to highlight this idea of wokeness and how the teaching of racial justice and oppression had gotten out of hand. So this became, you know, a talking point for politicians to begin to introduce a ban on critical race theory, which was never taught in public schools, but then, you know, taught only at the universities. But yet it was distorted in terms of how it was presented to local communities and voters. And, you know, it resulted in, you know, multiple states, you know, proposing laws and, you know, enacting laws that insisted either, you know, teachers present opposing views. And then, you know, this, you know, type of, you know, idea spread to Republican state legislator Matt Cross, who later sent a letter to all the school districts requesting that they flag over 800 books that make people, students feel guilty about their race or sex. And then, you know, later we see that, you know, this type of view kind of also penetrated in Florida, where they enacted a bill, HB 7, which was called the Stop Woke Act, that passed in spring 2022. And that placed restrictions on books said to indoctrinate or discriminate. And these books tend to discuss racial or social learning concepts and also acknowledge gender identities that created, you know, discomfort or guilt from, you know, the majority populations. If you look at a Pan America report, they reported, I believe last year, that there were over 54 divisive concepts or anti-CRT bills that were proposed in over 44 states. And as I said before, they would censor or suppress discussions on race, slavery, oppression, gender, LGBTQ. So as a result, you know, many public schools, like in most of the United States, have been infected. And that, you know, affects over millions of students.
You used the phrase a moment ago, make students feel guilty, and that has been a talking point in some of these conversations. I was looking on the Teachers College at Columbia University blog, and they had some of their scholars addressing sort of the book banning and book challenges, and didn't directly use that phrase, but alluded to this idea that we're protecting students from emotions that they can't handle or content that may provoke an emotion that they can't handle. And the scholars in that piece argued that students can handle a variety of emotions evoked by their reading content as long as they're properly supported, given information and context. Is there a sense that in this discourse of banning books that students can't handle things, because it doesn't seem that conversation is coming directly from very many students?
It's primarily the adults that are not ready to have these types of conversations with their kids. So usually when we look at who are the censors, these are really, you know, those that are adults, the parents in the community that are submitting, filing these complaints against these particular books.
So many books have teaching guides and parent guides, and they help with talking points, particularly if a parent didn't have education on a particular topic when they were coming up or it's unfamiliar to them. It offers talking points and ways to come at a conversation in a way that opens it and isn't, to go back to the phrase that's been used quite a bit, to make the students feel guilty. Do you feel that those teaching guides and teaching materials are helpful in this conversation, or is the conversation really kind of used in a political way and isn't open to ways we can all share information without banning books?
Well, I think it's more the latter, because in general, you know, since the, you know, most schools are set up in which allows parents the ability to object to books and to decide what their own children will read. But, you know, it's the school administrators that have the responsibility to uphold the, you know, the ability for other students to read, you know, the books, to keep it, keep these books in access for everybody else. So here it's like the parents, you know, have a right to limit, you know, their children's, you know, if they feel that their child's not ready for this particular book, then, you know, they have every right to say that, you know, their child won't read it. But the fact that it extends to everyone in the school and the district that cannot have access because one parent doesn't, you know, want their child to have exposure, it becomes problematic, because as public schools, you know, the administrators have a responsibility to allow students to have, you know, the opportunity to encounter books that, you know, they might not, you know, otherwise, you know, have access to, and also have the freedom to explore and to read. So I think these parents are denying, you know, others the opportunity to read these particular books. And as I said before, most of it is masked in the fear of the parents that aren't, you know, ready, you know, to have this conversation with their children. And yet, and we see now that there is a cultural war that are, you know, kind of creating sort of a, you know, backlash, you know, against cultural progress. And so there are those that are, you know, wanting to go back in time, in a sense, and not, you know, have discussions about, you know, things that have happened in terms of, you know, progress that have happened from the civil rights to LGBTQ movements, et cetera. And so those are, you know, other things that are being manipulated, you know, by the political, you know, space at the moment, creating this type of tension, you know, between the parents and the schools.
There's so much information available on social media, and we all have to sift through it carefully. One of the things that leapt out to me this summer was, as teachers were going back to school, particularly in Florida, were some of the posts that I saw. The teachers were posting pictures of themselves having to remove a number of books from the library they provide personally in the classroom. They texted about having, posted about having used their own personal funds to provide these books, that these books were representative, that they trusted students to think for themselves, and that indeed the students had had a lot of thought-provoking conversations from reading the books, and that they had to remove them in order to keep teaching, and that libraries were being shut as well at schools and being turned into different types of centers because so many of the books were no longer available. It seems that at the teacher level, they're concerned about how students will have enough materials to think for themselves and about what happens to students who no longer see themselves in literature. Is that part of the conversation that NCAC is privy to?
Yes, we work with the American Library Association. They're one of our coalition partners. And of course, we've observed there has been a chilling effect for librarians to select particular books, and also might cause them to avoid purchasing these books for their collections. And that's sort of the effect that the laws that have been introduced were intended to do. So these particular librarians are basically subjected to criminal law, you know, in terms of, you know, they could be labeled as, you know, pedophile or, you know, a groomer, you know, for having these particular books in particular states and subject to arrest. So that also, you know, prevents, you know, librarians for wanting to, you know, take a risk of losing their jobs and being publicly shamed, you know, for their, you know, doing their job. So I think that's something to also consider in terms of the environment in which the, you know, state laws have, you know, introduced these broad laws that, you know, put librarians in precarious positions, that it is, you know, very dangerous for them to, you know, to do their work, you know, in the sense like their, you know, their mission, you know, it would have been, you know, to be able to provide, you know, collections that are diverse and that have different stories that allow students to feel, you know, affirmed in their identities. But however, you know, they're, you know, in, you know, kind of a terrible situation in which that their livelihoods are being impacted by their decisions.
And some of the laws and regulations, because there's, you know, two different sets of things. It can be that the school board has made a regulation. It can be that the particular principal has issued a memo. And then it can be that there is a more sweeping or far-reaching law. It can be complicated as an educator who's trying to set up your classroom and get your curriculum ready for the year to understand how this applies to you. Few K through 12 or community college or even college professors have a confidence in their background in interpreting the law or interpreting how a regulation might apply to them when they have been acting in good faith the whole time.
Correct. So in those particular cases, we always advise the teachers or educators to speak to their union or also seek out legal advice before acting, because we want to make sure that they feel protected. And also in the cases of English teachers, you have the National Council of Teachers of English that provides support for teachers, as well as the ALA. So those are associations that are there to support the librarians and give them strategies on how to take care of themselves, their mental health, and then also how to navigate, you know, these particular spaces and, you know, what, they can do to continue in their livelihoods. In addition, as an organization, we also are able to mobilize community that can act in a way that the librarians cannot. So we have a Kids Right to Read network that we just launched to do just that, to bring all the anti-educational censorship groups together nationwide and to provide, kind of a mass to support these particular librarians when challenges come, to light. But in general, what we also ask, librarians to do is, to make sure that they have, clear challenge policies and that the policies are followed. So I think here that is something, we see in the press where, books are being improperly removed or things are being, the policies aren't being followed. So that's really when we get involved and write a letter is when we see, books being removed improperly without going through the challenge process. So here, we also ask that community members, when they hear about these challenges, that they speak up at a school board meeting, they run for school board positions, and they seek allies, parents to write letters to the local state politicians and also contact the local media or basically to write an op-ed, are examples. So here, the idea really is that you have to insist that the superintendents and library directors follow the book challenge policies and not let them remove books without due process.
And there's more information about that on your website. One of the things that was on my mind as I was prepping for this was how often there's a misunderstanding that if a book has an LGBTQ plus character, it does not mean the book in any way has sexually explicit information, sexual scenes, anything at all to do with sexual ed content. And so do these policies allow people to write an explanation to help deal with these misconceptions?
Well, generally what happens in terms of the book review, most schools and districts have a group of multi-stakeholders, which include librarians, parents, teachers, a student that are in charge to read the entire book as a whole before, making comments on whether or not to keep the book. It does involve reading, the entire book. A lot of times what we see is that the challenges to particular titles come from, groups that are, conservative action groups that target books, as being age inappropriate. And, these lists are being disseminated throughout the country. And these organizers of groups don't read the books. They just take objectionable, sections out of the book without, considering it as a whole. Most of the books that you see or all of the books that you see in libraries, school libraries have been already through a book selection review process, and which involves it already having educational merit. So it'd be really doubtful that any librarian would select any type of book that does not have, educational, merit to belong in the collection in the first place.
When I was looking at the statistics about the books themselves that are most often banned, 75% are fiction, 24% are nonfiction, 1% is poetry. And overwhelmingly, it's YA, young adult, that's banned. Is there a reason why the concern coalesces around young adults reading?
Well, I think it ties to the parents' comfort. A lot of these topics involve, some might have, profanity, some might have, sexual content. And I think a lot of times the parents aren't ready to have these conversations with their kids. And their idea really is to protect them as a minor from, age inappropriate materials, which is basically code for, their parents not being able to have a conversation with their kids about these topics that do affect their everyday or, their community members of, people that, their kids might already have, experience, or have knowledge about.
There can be a sense that book banning is a newer tool, or that it only started in the 20th century and that we're reviving it now. But historians date it back centuries. They date it back to ancient history, when different texts were banned or were considered objectionable by different rulers. And one of the things that historians point to is that it's consistently used as a struggle for political control. Is that what you're seeing, that there are rises of book bans in times when there are greater contentions and divides in the country?
Well, again, yes. I mean, I think it's a reflection of what the transformation that, you know, our country is going through. And most of it we could probably see if we go back to, you know, the election of President Obama and the rise of the Tea Party and, you know, the election of Trump and, you know, the Charlottesville, you know, kind of protest or riots that we saw there. And then also the January 6th. So all of that kind of shows like the, you know, the inability, I guess, of the, you know, the our nation to actually encounter and confront our historical past. So I think here we're seeing that. And now, you know, it's manifesting in many different ways. And, you know, again, you know, most of what we see here, you know, in terms of like the book bans, you know, it is a story about, you know, power. It is a story about, you know, nation building and state, you know, kind of function in terms of cultural hegemony, you know, in terms of like how we see ourselves. And, you know, most, you know, so here it's basically a struggle, you know, for cultural identity and dominance. And I think that's, you know, what we're seeing, you know, in the past, you know, 20 years or so, 15 years, there's been, you know, pushes to decolonize, you know, curriculums. There's been push to offer diverse literature. There's been, you know, progress in terms of, you know, particular groups being having access to higher education and also, you know, access to social mobility and, you know, opportunities through theater and, you know, representation in all kinds of fields. So I think here, you know, we're seeing, you know, kind of a confrontation between, you know, the status quo and, you know, progress.
Well, the idea of banning texts or information is not new. The strategies that groups are using to challenge books seems to be a bit different than it was in the past. What different strategies are you seeing?
Well, the idea is that it's that we're using social media is going to be one aspect, and a lot of the social media tools allow you know, certain things, these issues to become viral, and so I think that's one thing to know. But in terms of the social media, which I'll return to in a second, really the idea in terms of this, you know, idea of book bans is basically for these particular communities that are having progress to repress knowledge and actually their access to knowledge to empower them as groups. So I think that's also something that's happening in terms of the, you know, cultural homogeny that we're seeing here, is the idea of removing knowledge, because knowledge is power, right? From these particular groups, and to, you know, not, you know, allow them, you know, the opportunity to progress. is one aspect in terms of the effects of this type of movement. But I think if we focus on, you know, one particular group that has been really active in driving the majority of the bans in the country, the conservative political group called Moms for Liberty. Basically, we've seen this group in action for probably the last year and a half, two. And they, you know, they work under a PAC, and, you know, they have, you know, been criticized for having ties to networks within the Republican Party. And, you know, their party has, you know, kind of a, you know, tactic, you know, strategically to impose their ideological constraints on public schools and libraries. You know, they have, you know, a particular vision, and, you know, this is kind of the mechanism in which they do it. But most of these groups that I've mentioned that are part of this Moms for Liberty and their chapters, you know, they have over 200 plus chapters across the United States. And they, you know, are sharing lists of books to challenge, you know, to parents across the country. And they swarm school board meetings. They demand rating systems for libraries. They use language about grooming and pornography, and even file criminal complaints against school officials, teachers, librarians. And their efforts generate headlines and also campaign donations to the to themselves as well as the Republican Party. And also they divide parents against educators. And that also leads to movements to defund public libraries and defund, you know, schools and school libraries. So really their campaigns are, you know, lead to censorship or preemptive, you know, kinds of censorship. And also, you know, chilling effect to select curriculum and library resources, which is their intent. And we've seen this in Texas, we've seen it in Florida, and we also see it in Georgia, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, and Virginia.
While this is going on, there are groups who are fighting back to keep books on shelves, and this includes different publishers, libraries, student protests. How are groups working together, and how are they mobilizing to keep books on shelves?
That's a really great question. There are many statewide groups out there, you know, from, you know, Florida, Freedom to Read. You have Diverse Books. You have Red, Wine, and Blue. You have, you know, PEN America that's opened a Free to Be campaign with the ACLU. You also have Unite Against Book Bans from American Library Association. That's also a national campaign pushing back. And most recently, our organization, NCAC, has launched the Kids Right to Read Network, which is a national coalition of advocates defending the freedom of expression in communities across the country. We are actively working to prevent the removal of books from libraries at the local level. And these groups have access to common resources and experts, and they are working collaboratively across the network to strengthen strategies to build power on the community level. And all these groups across the you know, the country are passionate about free expression and you know, building power against these attacks.
We're starting to run out of time, and I want to make sure we get to cover the things that you'd like to. What else would you like listeners to know?
Well, I think most importantly is to get involved, you know, to, you know, attend school board meetings and sign up to speak, write letters to your school administrators and board members and local officials. So I think by putting your opinions on the records, it shows to the district officials that those that are trying to remove books are not the only ones with strong opinions on these issues. And it also can help support local officials to make decisions that protect free expressions. Contact the local media and write letters to the editor of local publications. Letters to the editors are most likely to be published if they're short. And also, I would encourage you to join social media campaigns. Like the Freedom to Read, Unite Against Book Bans, as well as the you know, Kids Right to Read Network that we've launched. So these are opportunities to get involved, and then also you know, for, you know, kind of a mission of why to do it. You know, think about, you know, helping students, you know, connect with, you know, these books that would reflect their own lives. And also to help widen those that are not, you know, of these particular communities to see a changing world that embraces diversity and multiculturalism. So I think those are important to be able to unite, you know, together, and, you know, to express, you know, basically to assert our freedom of expression, and that, you know, this freedom is important for students, because they are the future generation that's going to lead our, you know, country in the years ahead. So we must, you know, fight for their, you know, their rights to access, you know, knowledge and information that can help change the world.
And is there work we can do through requesting books at indie bookstores so that it gets on their radar, different books, by asking for them there?
Well, I think at the bookstores, I don't know exactly how the bookstore process works. So I would imagine you could, you know, make a request for particular books at a bookstore, for sure. In terms of the particular books at schools, you could propose to teachers, and teachers, I believe, can submit every school year requests for adoption of particular books in their communities. Also, another way of, you know, getting books to communities that are being, you know, that are having challenges are to start maybe banned book clubs in your community, you know, find ways of doing book drives, you know, in the community to allow, you know, these particular books to reach, you know, those that are the books that are intended for. So there are ways of also, you know, finding, you know, ways to get access to books, but really the best way to do, you know, to get and to ensure that the books are in public libraries and also public schools is to be involved in your school district to look at what the policy says and also to encourage revisions so that the policies clearly state that, you know, freedom of expression is being respected. And that, you know, the kids are, you know, getting access to books that they need to, you know, to be fully educated, as, you know, as the First Amendment ensures, you know, for students that are, you know, public school students to be able to have, you know, access to literature. So I think that's something for us to consider.
And finally, what do you hope this episode sparks?
Well, I hope it sparks action. I hope it sparks curiosity in terms of wanting to learn what your policies say, and also inspires those to run for school boards, because I think a lot of individuals are interested in this issue, but are not realizing that the minority of groups are the censors are the minorities, but they're speaking for everyone. So I think to have a louder voice and to show that they're our oppositions to the current efforts to remove books would be a movement that is much needed to guarantee that, you know, this doesn't happen, you know, for future generations, and that we can bring our, you know, society to another level, that, you know, we are inclusive and that we are very mindful of, you know, other stories, and that we can, you know, grow and progress and learn from our history.
Dr. Emerson, thank you so much for being here and telling us about the National Coalition Against Censorship and your work as the Youth Free Expression Program Director. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler, and you're listening to The Academic Life. Please join us again.